So this is a panel idea sort of came together. Had it when I was at Claremont doing a presentation there. And then I have never met Sue before, but we're grateful to have her and Warner. And then there's myself and Ron. And then Tristan Call should show up later, I hope. If not, that's fine, more time for us. So I think what we'll do is I'll begin, and then we'll have, I don't know what order.
It's in the program.
Whatever's in the program, we'll follow that order there. So after me, Sue can go, and then Tristan, if he's here. If not, we'll skip and have Ron and Warner go last. So I'll try to be brief. My presentation is way too long. The title of my paper is Occupy Zarahemla. And I want to begin talking about Occupy movements. For many, these movements erupted in New York City and then they spread throughout the U.S. And they've been difficult for people to understand. What are these Occupy movements? Where's the leadership? Why not make a list of demands? Why all this anarchist nonsense? Consensus? Fingers? You're never going to reach regular Americans like this. The argument goes that Occupy must come up with demands. It must impose discipline on the movement. They have to do certain things to be taken seriously. They must take a recognizable and familiar form. Of course, they want to do this so they can transfer its energy into partisan politics. Of course, this would also mean the end of Occupy. Demands could be met, armies recalled, and we can all get back to normal. This is to profoundly misunderstand what's at the heart of Occupy. If Occupy has anarchist roots, then the fundamental demand is to never go back to normal. Occupy is more than a movement against Wall Street. As Matt Taibbi, writer for Rolling Stone, explained, Occupy is ultimately about providing a forum for people to show how tired they are, not just of Wall Street, but everything, a place to escape the life-killing chase for money, money, and more money, where the only thing that changes from minute to minute is that every tick of the clock brings with it another space-age vendor dreaming up some new way to try to sell you something or reach into your pocket. Occupy is a visceral, impassioned, deep-seated rejection of the entire direction of our society, a refusal to take even one more step forward in the shallow commercial abyss of phoniness, short-term calculation, withered idealism, and intellectual bankruptcy that American mass society has become. If there is such a thing as going on strike for one's culture, this is it. On December 2011, the magazine Title, dedicated to Occupy Theory, published a message they entitled Communique Number 1. Operating in the realm of narrative and story, it labeled the stories told since our birth as a world of ghosts and illusions that have haunted our minds our entire lives, and contrasted those stories with the hope for a new one, a new vision for humanity. Occupy is a place, quote, for refugees from a dreamland seeking asylum in the actual. A place where, for once, no one is trying to bleed you or sell you something. A place where people are free to dream of some other way of being human beings, to get along, beyond auction democracy, tyrannical commerce, and the bottom line. The communique states, this is what we seek to occupy. We seek to rediscover and claim the world. Many believe we have come to Wall Street to transact some kind of business with its denizens, to strike a deal. But we have not come to negotiate. We have come to confront the darkness at its source, here where the Big Apple sucks in more of the sap from the national tree than it needs or deserves. As if spliced from some Edenic forebearer, serpent-sized worms feast within, engorged on swollen fruit. Here the world is chewed and digested into bits, as tiny and fluid as electrons that traders use to bring nations and homeowners to their knees. We see that the basic quantum of experience has become the transaction, that life's central purpose is to convert all existence into tradable currency. We have come here to doubt, to dispute that plan. When we peek at the blueprints made for the project, we see drawn there a fantastic land of gaudy castles, surrounded by a protective fence of broken glass, and outside this territory, a vast, denuded plain scribbled with the words rabble, suckers, consumers. Then, what do we want from Wall Street? Nothing, because it offers us nothing. We have come here to assert our real selves and lives, to build genuine relationships with each other and the world, and remind ourselves that another path is possible. If the phantoms of Wall Street are confused by our presence in their dreams, so much the better. It is time that the unreal be exposed for what it is. On the rare occasion when neoliberals admit our system may not be the best, we are assured there is no other system. This is Tina. This is what Margaret Thatcher was famous for saying. There is no alternative. Occupy finds itself located in the counter-belief there are thousands of alternatives. Occupiers have sought to break the frame of the narrative. A non-negotiable rejection of the official narrative on economics and politics in our society. A rejection of conditioned responses to that narrative, acting on their own authority and without reference to authority. Occupy is an experiment, then. What will the future look like? How will we get there? This is what Occupy hopes to discover through experiments. Liberty and experiments alone can determine the best forms of society. This is the imaginative power of the Occupy movements. As Tolkien reminded us, A single dream is more powerful than 1,000 realities. Another world isn't only possible, other worlds have happened in the past. We may discover, in fact, there have been nothing but other worlds. Unlike Lehi and his family, we have no promised lands to flee to, no undiscovered country. With nowhere to go, we must hollow out a new way of living in the here and now and give up superficial, foolish notions we can correct what is wrong merely by tinkering. The changes that are required are fundamental changes in the way we live. Like Samuel occupying the walls of Zarahemla against the Nephites who had lost their way, occupy represents a voice that we should be wary not to ignore. I believe that Mormon scripture is both complementary with Occupy critiques of our current narrative and also prophetic in showing us a way forward, a way forward many have begun to articulate. Both the Occupy movements and Book of Mormon agree in large part as to what it ails us. They speak of despising and grinding the face of the poor, robbing and oppressing the poor by withholding food from the hungry, clothing from the naked, and in its place, a culture obsessed with vanities, costly apparel, and mammon, which inevitably results in class distinctions and great inequality in the land. Mormon prophesies that not only will inequality reign, but even the Holy Church of God will love money, substance, fine apparel, and adorning of its churches more than the poor, the needy, the sick, and the afflicted. Is this diagnosis much different than Occupy, which complains that the 1% have accumulated most of the wealth, withholding from the 99% and leading to unparalleled inequality? This stems from what Nibley called Samuel's Law, that when the economy becomes the main and engrossing concern of a society, or in the routine Book of Mormon phrase, when they begin to set their hearts upon riches, the economy will self-destruct. Or as the LDS First Presidency proclaimed in 1875, one of the great evils which our own nation has menaced, wonderful growth of wealth in the hands of a comparatively few individuals. Like those ancient Nephites, we are cursed because of our riches, and our riches are cursed because we have set our hearts upon them. So both the Book of Mormon and Occupy map out the rise of corporations or combinations that ingratiate themselves in the political sphere where they collude with government in order to gain even more wealth and power. Having learned the great Mahan secret, they may murder and get gain. It's precisely this collusion that Occupy and Book of Mormon argue undermines freedom. Rooted in the satanic creed that having staked a claim on all the riches of the earth, it is then an easy matter to buy up political, military, and church support and run the whole show. Or as one Occupy member described it, grab all the money and resources, control the political and judicial processes, and underfund and discourage universal education to the point people are ignorant of history and how they are being screwed by their betters. In such a system, the resources of this world are not used to sustain life, but life itself is converted to property. Only in a counterfeit economy such as this world must one sell oneself in order to obtain what God has freely given. We are told we can have anything in this world, but we have to have money, and that will require conversion of life, either your own or of someone else's. The Book of Mormon charts clearly how such groups will obtain the sole management of the government, destroy the regulations of the government, and thereby trample the poor and meek under the feet, while the, quote, guilty and wicked go unpunished because of their money, so that they, quote, may get gain and glory of the world. This is the world we live in, where in mockery of the biblical concept of Jubilee, creditors instead of debtors are bailed out, where instead of doing something to protect debtors, the government essentially declares no debtor should ever be allowed to default, where too-big-to-fail institutions are bailed out by taxpayers, secure in the knowledge they would not be allowed to collapse, no matter their behavior, paying no taxes, but instead delivering vast sums of money from their even vaster profits to legislators and lobbyists. At this point, it is not entirely clear why an institution like Bank of America should not be considered part of the federal government, other than the fact that it keeps its own profits. A recent example of corporate life conversion would be the actions of Goldman Sachs. Many are familiar with the housing market collapse. Not as many are familiar with the worldwide food shortage that was caused at the end of 2006, when 200 million people, mostly children, couldn't afford food and sank into malnutrition. Despite an increase in wheat production, a slight decrease in demand, food prices skyrocketed. Much like the housing crisis, Goldman Sachs and others, in fine Book of Mormon fashion, lobbied until regulations were destroyed, turned contracts into derivatives, and gave birth to the food speculation market. The world's wealthiest speculators turned the world's food into a casino, where the chips were the stomachs of hundreds of millions of innocent people. They gambled on increasing starvation, and they won. Their wasteland moment created a real wasteland. As Gene Ziegler, the UN Special Rapporteur on Right to Food, calls it, a silent mass murder. I'm going to skip a lot of here, some of the issues of how money and the 1%, the Book of Mormon, for example, the military-industrial complex, where money and the treasures of the world are used to go to war and create warfare. Education, I think, is an important one. In the sixth chapter of Nephi, we find this. There began to be some disputings among the people, and some were lifted up in pride and boastings because of their exceedingly great riches. And the people began to be distinguished by ranks according to their riches and their chances for learning. And some were ignorant because of their poverty, and others did receive great learning because of their riches. One of the catalysts for the Occupy movements that began in the UK was the attempt to monetize education, similar to what we have here in the US. Not only did students fear they would soon face a lifetime of crushing debt, but that monetization of learning would fundamentally change the nature of education from a good in and of itself to a means of obtaining money. Nibley pointed out long ago the dangers of the university when more lunch or money becomes our lens. While it is true that those in poverty can obtain learning in America, unlike the bookworm, it is also true that it comes at a price, a potential lifetime of non-bankruptible debt peonage. High tuition costs and university degree are a prerequisite for employment. This means that for most, debt is a precondition for entry into the workforce. In short, you have to pay for access to work with your later work. At present, U.S. students' loans are nearly $1 trillion, the largest personal consumer debt in the U.S. It's only a matter of time until it's going to burst. One-third of loans are already in default. And if you look at the prospects for future employment, they're even more dire. In my field, LSAT entrance exams have dropped 17%. Exiting law students, unemployment is now 45%. If you want to learn for learning's own sake, university teaching is not really a realistic option for many people, where contingent instructors teach 40 to 50% of all classes. Since 1976, when student loans have become non-bankruptable, tuitions have increased 6.5 times the rate of inflation, 2.5 times the rates of the housing market, with universities and lending institutions continually raising the debt students must undertake, securing the knowledge this debt will follow you until death. It's non-bankruptible. And if that wasn't bad enough, the parting shot by a leaving Republican Congress has increased interest rates on student loans, and for those currently in the university, well, with the new laws, your interest accumulates while you're in school now. It's no longer deferred. The Book of Mormon, at a minimum, suggests that when education is treated like a commodity, it leads to class distinctions, great inequality. In the U.S., the student loan system has been a major complaint of Occupy movements, a system where the banks and federal government maintain the student loan program and ensure the loans will be held over their heads forever. And now they get held over your parents' heads as well because they have to co-sign. What I'm describing here is the antithesis of what I think the Lord's economy, what the Book of Mormon describes. He says, "I stretched out the heavens, I built the earth, and all things therein are mine. And it is my purpose to provide for my saints, for all things are mine, but it must needs be done in mine own way. And behold, this is the way I have decreed, that the poor will be exalted, and that the rich are made low. For the earth is full, there is enough and to spare. Therefore, if any man shall take of the abundance which I have made, and impart not his portion according to the law of my gospel unto the poor and needy, he shall with the wicked lift his eyes up in hell, being in torment. The air, the water, the sun, the soil, the earth, all this abundance, everything we can need, was given from the start as a gift." This is the same truth the economist Henry George spoke of. "Who made the earth that any man can claim such ownership, or any part of it, or the right to give, sell, or bequeath it? Since the earth was not made by us, but is only a temporary dwelling place on which one generation of men follow another. Since we find ourselves here, are manifestly here with equal permission of the Creator, it is manifest that no one can have an exclusive right of ownership in the land, and that the rights of all men to the land must be equal and inalienable. There is enough to spare for everyone, but it cannot be done through Satan's counterfeit economy. It is my belief the alternate story that Occupy seeks to inhabit, and which the Book of Mormon advocates, rests on two beliefs, that everything in this world, even our life, is a gift, and we should deny not those gifts to anyone, but share them liberally and in common. That the world does not function this way should not surprise us, for once you have accepted the counterfeit story, you can have anything in this world for money, and that you prosper or fail according to your efforts, is only a matter of time until such inequalities arise. The military-industrial complex, our culture's obsession with riches and great inequality in the land, ultimately stem from this root, a denial of the gifts of God. And what better economic system to fit such a worldview than capitalism? This seeks profit everywhere and turns everything from gifts into private property. The air we breathe, the water we drink, even ideas, where one man can claim special financial rewards for being the last link in the complicated social process that produced the invention. And throws wit, he mocks the logic of a system where if a man walk in the woods for love of them half each day, he's in danger of being regarded as a loafer. But if he spends his whole day as a speculator, shearing off those woods and making earth bald before her time, he's esteemed an industrious and enterprising citizen, as if a town had no interest in its forests but to cut them down. In one of the earliest U.S. Supreme Court cases, Johnson v. McIntosh, the court decided Native Americans have no property rights. Why? Because the use of their land is not exclusive. The court explained because they don't privatize their land, other words, hold in common, and they did not prevent others from using it, read selfishness. Therefore, they had no property rights. In other words, they did not believe they had earned their land by taking the gifts of God and borrowing others. By 1880, Congress prepared legislation to break up Indian communal lands and break them into small private possessions. Senator Henry Dawes explained it. "There was not a family in that whole nation that had not a home of its own. There was not a pauper in the nation, and the nation didn't own a dollar. It built its own schools, its own hospitals, yet the defect of that system was apparent. This is the defect of the Native Americans. They have got as far as they can go because they own their land in common. There's no enterprise to make your home better than your neighbor's. There's no selfishness, which is at the bottom of all civilization. This is a story as old as Adam. We're on a new world that God has given a certificate entitled Man to Food and Raiment. But the unrighteous man comes along and finds a facsimile of the same in God's coffers and appropriates it. And so it is, the gifts of God are taken by some as if they were theirs to own and denied or granted to others on the basis of money. Thoreau calls it one of the most extensive systems of counterfeiting the world has ever seen, a system where relations of culture are replaced by intellectual property, relations of obligation and gift replaced by consumer debt, relations of trust and community replaced by security and surveillance. Inevitably, everything is taken from the commons, wealth is concentrated in the hands of a few, while those without must go into lifelong debt that they can never pay off just to have access to their necessities. As a result, once everything has become private property, those without must accept or die of hunger. In feudal times, slaves, serfs, and tenants gave a lifetime of labor to the enrichment of their landowners. Today, the proceeds of our labor goes to the owners of money, an ingenious substitute for the chain and whip of the slave driver, according to Ambrose Bierce. Meanwhile, those with riches assure us they have earned them through their virtue and their cunning, their skill and labor. As Mitt Romney, I'm not worried about the poor, proclaimed to all of America from his holy lectern, or what Zoramites might call a ramyumptum, I didn't inherit my money from my parents. What I have, I earned. I worked hard the American way. In other words, I deserve the wealth I have because I alone earned it. Those who are poor deserve their poverty because they have failed to earn wealth. You see, if the American way means anything, it means never acknowledging the hands of another in your success. Invisible hands, perhaps, but never the hand of a living soul. As Nibley reminds us, we should be wary of such talk, because no one is more completely of the world than one who lives by the world's economy, whatever his display of open piety. Such is the curse Samuel spells out before Zarahemla. You have set your hearts upon riches. You do not remember the Lord your God and the things which he hath blessed you, but you do always remember your riches, not to thank the Lord for them. They simply refused to regard or treat their riches as gifts, insisting they were earnings. At this point, let me propose a way forward. We mistakenly believe that property defines our relationship to a thing, but this isn't really the case. Property in the end is not about our relationship to things, but an arrangement between people concerning things. As English law puts it, we hold things against the world. That is an understanding between ourselves and everyone on the planet. They will refrain from interfering with our private possessions. I believe 4 Nephi describes the antithesis of this, a system where instead of alienation and separation, we have community, and instead of property, we have commons. I often wonder whether we miss some of the more subversive implications of this statement. Quote, they had all things in common, therefore there were no rich nor poor, bond or free, but they were all made free and partakers of the heavenly gift. In a mad rush to become self-reliant, we fail to see that in the very act we are denying the gifts of God and destroying any possibility for community. Self-reliance and holding all things in common are incompatible. In the end, a life that seeks to be independent of others for the meeting of one's need is a life without community. Think of the people in 4 Nephi. Were they self-reliant? Perhaps community-reliant, but individually, surely not. The scriptures state that if you're not one in earthly things, you cannot obtain heavenly things. But we quickly gloss over the reason. For when we refuse to accept the gifts of God and share them in common, and instead create property, we are by that very act alienating or separating our hearts and minds from one another. One need only look at the dynamics of money and property that have destroyed family relationships to understand what it does to community. Community is nearly impossible in a highly monetized society like our own. If you are self-reliant, then you don't depend on your neighbors, or indeed anyone. The financially independent person is not bereft of community because he meets all of his needs via money. He's bereft because he is not meeting his needs except through money. Remember, it was Cain who first sought self-reliance after killing his brother, declaring, and Cain glorified in which he had done, saying, I am free. Surely the flocks of my brother fall into my hands. I am free. I don't need anyone else. What better description can there be of the loss of community in today's world? In gift cultures, people depend on one another for life's necessities. It was only with enemies and strangers that payment was demanded. We have become a nation of shopkeepers, alienated from one another with no ties that bind us. We don't really need each other. We don't need to know the person who grows, ships, or processes our food, makes our clothing, builds our homes, creates our music, fixes our car. We don't even need to know the person who takes care of our babies while we're at work. We are dependent on the role, but only incidentally on the person fulfilling the role. We need someone to do the job, but not the unique individual. They are replaceable, and by the same token, so are we. Whatever it is, we can just pay someone to do it, as long as we have money. And how do we get it? By performing some other specialized role, more likely or not, that amounts to someone paying us for doing something for them. This explains one of the fundamental obstacles to community. in our current systems. Community involves a social cohesion that is destroyed by the individual ethic of our modern capitalist society. Intimacy does not come from co-consumption, but co-creation. In our monetized society, we have creativity, but it's always mediated with money. Obligations and gifts bind people together even after they have been paid. But debts bind us only for as long as the debt exists. The relationship dies on payment. It is precisely when the money changes hands that both parties can walk away and have nothing to do with each other. Many of us nowadays no longer aspire to financial independence, the state in which we have so much that we don't need anyone. While there may be human and earthly limits, there are, according to Wendell Berry, these aren't confinements, but rather inducements for formal collaboration, elaboration, elegance, to the fullness of relationships and meaning. Some things, though limited, are inexhaustible. For example, an ecosystem, even that of a working forest or farm, so long as it remains ecologically intact, is inexhaustible. In a proper economy, things would be designated as priceless, beyond any price that could be set on them. These things would be part of the commons. Things like water, air, soil, internet, human knowledge would not be owned privately, but held in common. By starting to create a gift economy, not only would our quality of life remain high, but we'd reduce our dependence on the market. This could be done locally. For example, when I clean my garage and I see I have a lawnmower, and everyone in my entire house street does, hundreds and hundreds of lawnmowers for blocks after blocks. These are things we can share: hedge clippers, blowers, trimmers, so on. The same pattern repeated inside our homes with a variety of items, ever repeated in each household. There is simply no logical reason for every household to own a lawnmower, used only a few hours a month. Power tools even less. By sharing, we would need less money, less time earning it, less time consuming, and we'd find greater cohesion and greater community. And why don't we demand a jubilee and a forgiving of debts? In the ancient world, it was not repaying debts that was sacred, but your ability to forgive them, to cancel them. And maybe we should learn from that. While many are aware of the Rosetta Stone that was used to decipher hieroglyphs, even fewer are aware what was on it. It was a jubilee announcement. And what better time than now, when interest payments currently take up 15 to 70% of household income, a figure that doesn't even include student loans or the penalty fees on banks and credit cards. Not only would a jubilee relieve genuine human suffering, it would also be our way of reminding ourselves money is not ineffable, paying one's debt is not the essence of morality, that all these things are human arrangements, and if democracy means anything, it is the ability to agree to arrange things differently. Many of these ideas are rooted in King Benjamin's idea, where dependence, not self-reliance, is what is important. The natural man is not a metaphysical state of an individual, but instead he has a social character. It is a state of rejecting communion with God and neighbor. It is a state of rejecting our radical dependence on each other. Benjamin reminds us that everything is a gift. And even more radical than any claim God may have, he transfers to our neighbor. We may ultimately realize that God gives us gifts to see what we'll do with them. As our example, he has given us this world, life, the privilege of practicing gift-giving. And for those who practice it, we are told the gifts will never run out, for all he has is ours. It is no coincidence that at the center of the Occupy movements were gifts, libraries, impromptu kitchens, places where there was no currency, food for all, and now Occupy farms where people can farm and share. These are just a few of the ideas that Occupy has began in seeking to decommodify the common goods through co-governance and shatter the assumption which underlies state capitalism. If you want to create a world of abundance, a world of the gift, you can start today by sharing whatever riches you have. This may go against your rational self-interest, but that is a very short-sighted self-interest. Because while money becomes slippery, the ties of community that gifts create will never become slippery, and they will persist through any calamity. We have seen firsthand how treasures can literally disappear when our hearts are set upon riches. But by setting our hearts on relationships and community over money, we invest in an economy of gratitude and gifts without an end. This is the wealth that fires cannot burn and thieves cannot steal. And then Sue's going to go next, and then we'll have Tristan, and then Ron, and then Warner.
So going along with that same idea, I just wanted to remind us of throughout the Book of Mormon, there are several times where it talks about where they had the ideal community. I just wanted to read the one that is from the first chapter of Alma. And it is chapter 1, verse 27, talking about how everybody did impart of their substance, every man according to that which he had, to the poor and the needy and the sick and the afflicted. They did not wear costly apparel, yet they were neat and comely. And thus they established the affairs of the church, and thus they began to have continual peace again, notwithstanding all their persecutions. So this was then, because it shows up several times in the Book of Mormon, to me, this is like the ideal, how, what the community should be. And it was the ideal for several years after Christ came. But then our greedy impulses kick back in, and we, you know, go back to where there are inequalities. I think, yeah, as was pointed out, you can just read the, certainly our American culture in the notion of really unequal. You got the 1% and everybody else. You've got, so economical inequalities. You've got the sharing, or I guess the bounty of our country. Again, inequality, the 1%, you know, controls most of it, etc. And so this idea of the Occupy grew up. The Zuccotti Park was the first real community that started establishing, and then there were other Occupies that sprang up. There was Occupy Oakland, Occupy San Francisco, that I went a few times because I live outside of San Francisco to the Occupy San Francisco. I was with one of the first gatherings that they had where, so in San Francisco on the Market Street, there is the Federal Exchange Building and a little bit of a sidewalk plaza that exists there. And people started camping out there, and the first Occupy rally started there. We marched up Market Street, and we went to the city and county building, and then we marched up to California Street and down California Street where there are banks, and we stopped along the way at the banks and, you know, protested the banks, got back down to the plaza. As things started, people started coming in and joining. The next thing you knew, there was like, because this was now, you know, where the big bankers come, people in their fancy suits have to come into this building, you know, they want to walk past everybody. So next thing you know, there's like yellow tape, you know, around the area in front of the federal building, and you have to show ID that you belong here and go in there. Next thing you know, police moved the campers from where they were, the occupiers from where they were there, but they let them be on the plaza that's between Market Street and the Ferry Building. And so Occupy San Francisco built up there. I am a nurse, and you know, I belong to the California Nurses Association, and we're a very progressive union. And so the idea of Occupy, there are people that are saying, our society is not just, and we need to do something about that. And it's something that nurses see, because we're, you know, we're right there on the front line of when you get sick, when things happen to you, and your family falls apart. You know, we're there, we're seeing it, and we've just seen things deteriorate more and more and more. So because we're nurses, we see, you know, that's what we're used to. We see there's some problem here, let's diagnose what the problem is, and then let's find ways to see if we can't fix it. So before Occupy Zuccotti Park happened, we were thinking in terms of, because we'd seen the 2008, you know, basically Wall Street and their financial schemes crash the economy. We saw the big banks and the various Goldman Sachs, you know, various people, institutions get bailed out with tax dollars, with our money. But then we were realizing, hey, wait a minute, we got sold out. So in before, I'm not exactly sure when that was, but we decided, well, we want to have let's just sit down and get some basic ideas, you know, what do we want here for our American society? And basically, based on what was Franklin Delano Roosevelt's second Bill of Rights, we decided that, you know, so we want to push for the Main Street contract to, you know, heal America. As, you know, nurses were healers. So we came up with, you know, we want to say, let's just, you know, make out the point. So we want jobs at living wages. We want to reinvest in America. We want guaranteed health care for all, good housing and protection from hunger. We want a just taxation system where corporations and the wealthy pay their fair share. We want equal equal access to quality public education, a secure retirement with the ability to retire with dignity, and a clean, safe, and healthy environment. And in June of 2011, because we were so, well, okay, that's good, and if we just kind of look at the big picture, what's the problem? And to us, Wall Street seemed to be the problem, because they were getting all the money, they were getting all the breaks, you know, profits are flowing again to them, we're still having trouble, you know, we're still paying, we're still out of work, we're losing our houses still, Wall Street's paying bonuses, living high again. It just seemed like there was hardly any time. And the next thing you know, just the very same year when they get bailed out, they're paying bonuses in the millions of dollars. Didn't y'all go, what? I thought you guys were, I thought there wasn't any money moving anywhere. And now you just, boom, you're right back to getting off with the millions of dollars of bonuses. So Wall Street's the problem. So in June, so this was before Zuccotti Park, June of 2011, we occupied Wall Street. Oh, is there
okay.
a...
You want me to do it?
Yeah, thanks. So first, I guess, medically-wise, the Robert Woods Johnson Foundation found that nearly one in five citizens in the United States in 2010 had unmet medical needs due to cost. So we're not going to the doctor. We're not getting the health care that we need because we're like, geez, I can't afford that. A friend of mine who happens to be the co-president of the National Nurses United that I belong to is basically saying, America's nurses see and feel the broad declines in health and living standards for their patients and their own families that are directly tied to the collapse in jobs, housing, health care, and other basics of what used to be called the American dream that happened because of the shenanigans on Wall Street and just the way our society has been going. And nurses say, we've seen enough. We want that to stop now. So we have the wealth. Where did it go? 720% of increase on Wall Street profits. Well, we were having 102% increase in unemployment rate, and we were losing our homes. All right, so Wall Street's the problem. Let's go protest. That's what we do as California nurses and the National Nurses United best. So we went. We took it to Wall Street in June of 2011. Basically, you know, gave them the message, we're here to heal America. This is what we want. And we're going to, you know, fight. So with the various Occupy encampments that were set up across the country, that were first aid stations, and we tried to support them. We helped set up the one in San Francisco, one in Oakland, the one in Zuccotti Park, and there was one in Washington, D.C., and we staffed them. You know, a little personal story. I work at UC San Francisco Medical Center, and I had a patient whose brother-in-law happened to be in the sheriff's department at San Francisco, sheriff's department. And he was running for sheriff. And when he came to visit his loved one, I took him aside and I said, because they had threatened at Zuccotti Park that they were going to take down, they were going to clear the park, they were going to take down the first aid tent. And I said to him, you're not going to take down the first aid tent at the San Francisco one, are you, like they're threatening to do in New York? And I'm the nurse taking care of his loved one. He says, oh, of course not. Of course not. Well, so not long after that, word got out that they were going to come and take down the San Francisco, occupy the whole encampment. And so nurses were called to go and basically defend the first aid tent. The night that I went, they didn't come, but I was actually looking forward to asking for, where is Sheriff Yamamoto? He promised me he was not going to do this. I want him right here in front of my face telling me that he's going to go back on his word. But it didn't happen that night. But we were involved in supporting the Occupy's encampments and giving first aid and help when we could. In, you probably read about, saw the pictures of UC Davis and what happened to those students there with the police officer that had industrial strength pepper spray, that there was just students sitting on the sidewalk, and he just walked along and sprayed them. Now, luckily, that officer, I don't know where he is, but he's not a UC employee anymore. And I think that the chancellor of UC Davis should have stepped down, but that didn't happen. But after that, then that almost strengthened UC Davis's resolve to have an Occupy footprint. So we actually had a first aid tent there with them that we were actually... I haven't had a call to go help staff it for a while, but even as late as last month, I was getting calls that I wanted to go over to Davis and help there at the tent. So what we nurses decided was that some of these things that we need, that we're being told there isn't the money for. So on the one hand, I'm a big enough idealist that I want the society where, as was in the Book of Mormon, probably what was supposed to happen with the United Order, everything is the Lord's and has been given to us here on this earth for our benefit. Therefore, everybody gets what they need. Everybody gives what they can. That's the kind of society I want. But until we get there, we nurses have some practical ideas of how to get some of the things in our society now that does cost money. There's this idea, it's called the, referred to as the Robin Hood tax, which is a financial transaction tax on every transaction that Wall Street makes. So it's 50 cents on every $100 of financial transaction on Wall Street. How could that be too much, or who would object to that? And well, of course, Wall Street does. But that would raise in America $350 billion a year, which would be money then that would be something that could fund our education that we need, where students don't have hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt just to get, you know, your bachelor's and perhaps your master's degree in education. You know, that would be a thing of the past. Would fund Medicare, Medicaid, so that people could get the health care that they need. Could fund child Head Start kinds of things, so that the kids could get a Head Start and could also get, you know, the nutrition that's also part of Head Start. You know, fund the food stamps program more, so that people can get all the various nutrition that they need. So this was like, for us, a step. So last May, we all went to Chicago. There were over 1,000 nurses. And this was the time when the G8 was supposed to meet. We planned it to be there when the G8 was supposed to be there, and then Obama moved that to Camp David. So we held the People's G8 in Daley Plaza, and... basically, it's, again, the same thing. You know, we want jobs with dignity. We want education that is available to everybody. We want a health care, a Medicare for all people to be able to retire with dignity. And so that was basically what we were saying is we want an economy for the 99%. Please. So this Robin Hood tax is not a tax on the people, but it's a tax for the people, letting banks pay their fair share. So this is just, I was way at the back, way at the back. But this is the nurses marching down the street on the way to Daly Plaza. And it was interesting, Rahm Emanuel, who's the mayor of Chicago, when we had planned this for months, we had gotten the permits that we needed, going to have in the Daly Plaza there was where our main rally was going to be. And 2 weeks, I believe it was before, maybe even a week before, we got word that they were pulling our permit, that we couldn't meet at Daly Plaza. You don't tell the California Nurses Association no after you've said yes like that. So we took them to court, and we did go to Daly Plaza. So we've done toe-to-toe with Rahm Emanuel. We're also of the opinion that these things are worth fighting for. We went to a court with Rahm Emanuel. When the Senate Finance Committee was considering, this was then, I guess in 2009, the health care bill. How's it going to be? How are we going to form it? What's it going to be? There were, I believe, 3 days of hearing. There were 45 panelists that came to testify for the hearing. They were insurance company executives. There were hospital executives. They were pharmaceutical company executives. Where was the patient? Who represented? Who was it? Us? And there's a group called Physicians for a National Health Program, and these physicians have, for several years, advocated for basically it's a single payer system, which is our Medicare, a single payer system, which is Medicare for all. That's what they have advocated for. They wrote to Senator Baucus, they called his office, they talked to his aides, they were trying to get a representative of the single payer idea, the Medicare for all idea, to be at this 45 member panel that was going to testify before the Senate what's the best direction we should be going for our national health care plan. And as it looked, as time got closer and closer to the actual Senate hearings, up to the day, and they realized that, you know, they're shutting us out. They're not going to have anybody talk about, you know, what are the virtues of Medicare for all. So they decided it's time to kick into civil disobedience mode. So there were, on one hearing day, there were 8 doctors and healthcare advocates that, as Senator Baucus, you know, banged his gavel down and was getting ready to start the hearing, one by one they stood up and said, why isn't there a single-payer advocate at this table? Why isn't Medicare for all being discussed here at this table? Why are there just people who benefit from this healthcare, you know, financially, make millions, billions of dollars in profit? Why are they the only people sitting at the table here? And one by one, of course, Baucus gaveled down and said, bailiff, please restore order to the hearing room. And the Capitol Police came and one by one took the individual out and arrested them. So that was 1 week. The next week, my nurses, we were having a gathering, a meeting there that day, and so we decided to join because, again, there were 3 physicians that were going to do this again, and 2 nurses decided we were going to join with the doctors and disrupt Congress again, which is a misdemeanor. So, as Senator Baucus, well, before, actually, before Senator Baucus gaveled the beginning of the meeting, there were about 30 nurses that we'd all come in. We'd had our red scrubs on under, we looked very demure in our little jackets over them. And we all took off our jackets, and with our red shirts, we had a little sign pinned on the back of us saying, you know, we want to hear about Medicare for All. And we all stood up, turned around with our backs to the senators, stood in silence for a minute, and then walked out. And we had lots of supporters in the audience, and so they all applauded us and supported us. You know, and the senators were just like, oh, no, what's this? And so Max Baucus started talking about, well, we appreciate everybody's opinions, and we want you to know everybody will be heard. Please don't, and is about to say, please don't disrupt. And a nurse stands up, you know, I'm Deanne, and I've been a nurse for 35 years, and today's Florence Nightingale's birthday, and we should be having somebody from Medicare for All be up here, you know, and he's a bailiff, please clear the way here. And they take her off, and she's going up, and things calm down, he's about to start again. I stand up, and I say, you know, the people up here at this table have failed us for 30 years. You know, we want to know why Medicare for All is not being discussed. And then, the gavel goes down, and out I go. So actually, this was just me and Deanne going into the paddy wagon here in the bottom. The Medicare for All, it turned out, so that day, one of my fellow nurses at the hospital was saying, you know what, we were sitting at lunch, and we've got CNN on, and all of a sudden I'm realizing, that's Sue's voice. She's not here. Where is she? She's coming from the TV. And so actually I was on a loop on CNN that day, that as I was going out, because I was saying a little ditty that I had written a long time ago, healthcare is a human right. You know, come and join us with this fight. No more blue crosses, double crosses. Goodbye, Aetna and blue, you know, whoever bosses. We want guaranteed health care. So I guess CNN thought that was a catchy tune or something, and they played it as a loop. But it turned out that day got more, information about Medicare for All than had happened all up to that point. For education of American citizenry. So sometimes it's worth it to be doing the civil disobedience. I mean, of course, the Occupy movement, you know, occupying the parks ended up being civilly disobedient. Not really, because I think the First Amendment gave us the right to be in public property. But nonetheless, they cleared us off and took us away. But so why do we occupy? Because things are unjust. You know, you've got a big corporation like BP that gets to go to the Gulf and say, oh, yeah, sure, we got a plan if something goes wrong. We don't have, there's nobody holding their feet to the fire. They've ruined the whole Gulf Coast. They ruined thousands of people's livelihoods. And yet, what do you see now on the television? Sponsored by BP, commercials of, come to the Gulf Coast, oh, fishing is as great as it ever has been, oh, our beaches are beautifully and, you know, wide. BP commercials, you know, they have their hand, you know, and they're lying to us. And this is why we occupy, to stop the lies. So, my time is up. Thank you.
Introduce myself really quick. My name is Tristan. I'm from Nashville, Tennessee. First, I want to recognize really quickly the importance of three things that have been mentioned so far. One, Josh's mention of the food crisis, which is, I think, the most important crisis occurring in the world today, though it's not particularly visible in the United States. But millions, maybe billions of people are going to die because of it, and already have in some cases. Wish we had more time to talk about that today. But the second being that the National Nurses United may be the either most important or at least most active union in the country right now in going beyond the traditional mandate of just getting more money for themselves. And I want to honor the work that National Nurses United has been doing. And the third is the Josh's mention of student debt, which I think will almost certainly become the flash point issue in the coming months with the heirs of Occupy Wall Street. So the first thing I want to mention is I think that talking about occupation and direct action requires a little bit of a different approach to scripture than we sometimes use in the LDS faith. And I think that approach has been pioneered really well by some Mormons and many not as something called, which most people are probably familiar with, liberation theology. What makes it different, right, is that typically, at least in my upbringing, we read the scriptures and then we try to apply those scriptures to our lives. We call that likening, right? The approach of liberation theology is rather different. The approach of liberation theology is that we carefully observe the world around us. We carefully look at what's going on, and then we approach scripture, right? So there's a difference, right? And when you approach scripture from the perspective of having looked carefully at what's going on around you and then looking for the resources of how to survive and proceed, right? So I'm going to try a really quick, very simple liberation theology exercise here with this example. All this can and should be done in much greater detail, much greater historical context as well. Most liberation theologians spend a lot of time on history. I'm not going to do that right now. But imagine that I am. So I'm going to read Psalm 82, three verses from it. Defend the poor and fatherless. Do justice to the afflicted and needy. Deliver the poor and needy. Rid them out of the hand of the wicked. They know not, neither will they understand. They walk in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are out of course. So we'll return to that first, but you can think about that. It's pretty clear, right? Defend the poor and fatherless, the afflicted and needy. So if we move to analyzing our situation, I'll do it really briefly because everybody's pretty familiar with this stuff, right? But we've had 33 wars since 1990 waged by the United States, right? They add up. We have over half of the world's military expenditure in the United States for our military. We have a network of over 1,000 military bases off of U.S. soil around the world, right? So if you think about that, there is no context to understand our situation from other than the context of empire. It's the largest empire in the history of the world. There's no question about it. Second, and we can go on about context in terms of many different issues. I'm just going to talk really briefly about war and about capitalism. So the second is capitalism, right? Everybody is pretty familiar with what the idea of the 1% is. Let's remind ourselves, the 1% of, in terms of accumulated wealth, hold over a third of the financial assets in the United States. Right? The top 10% own over 80% of the assets in our country. The work that I did, and so, for example, so I go to Vanderbilt University, we calculated it out. Our provost makes in an hour what it takes a dining worker 2 months full-time to make. That's typical in the United States right now. We calculated it out for the Target Corporation. It takes him an hour to make what one of his janitors makes in a year. So when we talk about wealth inequality, this is also unprecedented in the history of the world. Right, old empires didn't approach this kind of systematic wealth inequality. And then the work that I do, I work with low-wage workers in Nashville. Two-thirds of low-wage workers in the United States have had some form of their wages stolen in the last week. Two-thirds, right, of the people making, like, minimum wage, either through violations of wage and hour laws, through Federal Labor Standards Act, they're not being given minimum wage, they're not being given overtime. That's typical for low-wage workers in the United States. For those that maybe aren't themselves low-wage workers to get a handle on. If you are a low-wage worker, then you know this really well already. So I'm going to give two examples of things that have happened in Occupy Nashville. The first, I'm going to read out, because that will be quicker. Can I be heard? Is my phone working? Okay, great. I should have checked that earlier. The first night at Occupy Nashville had a deep impact on me. I was laying in the shadow of a trash can. I was looking at all night at the War Memorial Building, which is, we were on War Memorial Plaza, which is right next to the State Capitol Building in Nashville. And it says on that War Memorial Building, "America is privileged to spend her blood and her might for principles." And below that inscription, there are the names of more than 3,000 Tennesseans who died during World War I. Around the corner, there's a statue of running men with guns commemorating the dead in Korea. Other memorials remember other war dead. There's a statue of Alvin York for those people that, like I did, watched Sergeant York hundreds of times as a child. A lot of our neighbors on the plaza had their own war stories, some from Fort Campbell, who'd come down to the occupation risking court-martial, they said, for a couple of days of leave. One in particular I remember, a homeless veteran who did two tours with the Marines. He was my closest neighbor on the plaza my first night, but I left a couple dozen feet of space anyway because he would cry out loud in his sleep. At first I thought he was yelling at us to be quiet because a group of us were chatting, but then I realized he was out cold, but he would shout in an unintelligible, painful sound every few minutes. He was in shorts, didn't have a shirt, had a small blanket. And I thought about why we were there. Companies like General Electric, one of the biggest war profiteers in the country, that year made headlines for not paying any income tax. GE contributed nothing to the health care of the returned veterans who paid with mind and limbs so that GE could be safe to make a killer profit. As I fell asleep under the combined towers of Nashville's biggest banks, which are right above us, and the war memorial, it felt like an awful confirmation of what we've always known, that the rich make money from war, and the rest of us are expected, as always, to sacrifice everything for them to do so. This goes back, for me, in the memory of my own grandfather, who was an employee of General Electric when they initially began to be one of the largest war profiteers during World War II. So, I'm going to quote really quickly from, I think, the best expression of this analysis of war. It's from Eugene Debs' Miss Canton, Ohio speech, for which he was imprisoned under the Sedition Act in 1918. And he says, "Wars throughout history have been waged for conquest and plunder. In the Middle Ages, when the feudal lords who inhabited the castles set to enlarge their domains to increase their power, they declared war upon one another. They did not go to war themselves any more than the modern feudal lords, the barons of Wall Street, go to war. The feudal barons of the Middle Ages, the economic predecessors of the capitalists of our day, declared all wars, and then their miserable serfs fought all the battles. The poor, ignorant serfs had been taught to revere their masters, to believe that when their masters declared war on each other, it was their patriotic duty to fall upon one another and cut one another's throats for the profit and glory of the lords and barons who held them in contempt. And that is war in a nutshell. The master class has always declared the wars. The subject class has always fought the battles." I'll skip because I think it's clear enough from that where I'm headed. Right? So I'm going to give a second example, which is I work at a workers' center in Nashville, basically recovering stolen wages from that bosses have withheld from their workers. And a 17-year-old immigrant girl came in last week and told a story that she had worked 94 hours in 8 days, and she'd been paid $180 for it, so that's about $2 an hour. A little less than $2 an hour. And so we'd heard stories like this before, we'd worked on cases like this before. We worked with her to confront her bosses, who came in drunk and angry and in a team, and we also, not drunk, but in a team, explained very carefully what we would do to their business if they didn't pay up to what would be a minimum wage. And they ended up leaving $280 on the table after a lot, 2.5 hours of shouting. And that's the daily work that I do in Nashville, right? So those are the two examples of war and capitalism and what they mean. So let's return. So that's analyzing our context, right? That's what Nashville is for the poor. Those are the two main examples, I think, that help explain. I could talk about prisons, which would be maybe the clearest third. But let's reread the scripture really quick. "Defend the poor and fatherless. Do justice to the afflicted and needy. Deliver the poor and needy. Rid them out of the hand of the wicked. They know not, neither will they understand. They walk on in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are out of course." So, I think there's two ways to approach that for me. I think everybody has to analyze this really carefully with their own commitments, right? there's two ways to defend the poor and do justice to the afflicted and needy. One of those we call charity. I think that the way of doing that is to be there with them, right? And that's one of the ways that the Occupy encampments have attempted to do, right? And there's been a lot of discussion around this, right, of the difficulties of living among the homeless, of living among junkies, of living among people who experience violence from the police and pass it on to each other, right? But there's something to be said for being there in accompaniment with people who are afflicted. I think that the best way of understanding it is that said by Peter Singer, that you have to, in order to be a moral person, risk something morally equivalent to what other people are risking. And the second is to look at structural change. If structural violence, which Paul Farmer explains as structures which put some people at disproportionate risk of suffering, right, which is obviously the system we now live in, where the poor fight the battles and take the hits. That if we understand what structural violence is, then we have to think about what structural love would mean, right? What would combating structural violence look like? And I think other people are explaining fairly well what that would look like. And so I'm going to finish with saying that I think the best way of understanding this is not through writing, not through activism, sort of a big capital A, activism, but through something called the best theologians of our traditions call accompaniment. Eugene Debs said it really well, though not himself, someone who would call himself a theologian, but I think this is the best description of it. Better known descriptions of it maybe come from Oscar Romero or liberation theologians of Latin America, but his is good. And this is from his statement to the court when he was sentenced to prison for opposing World War I. "Your Honor, years ago I recognized my kinship with all living beings, and I made up my mind that I was not one bit better than the meanest on earth. I said then, and I say now, that while there is a lower class, I am in it. And while there is a criminal element, I am of it. And while there is a soul in prison, I am not free." And so for people that are already in that criminal element or in that lower class, I think they understand well what we tend to call solidarity as a method of approaching structural love for one another. I think for people that are not yet in the ranks of the people that that suffer most under our system, there's a solution to begin accompaniment. Some people call it class suicide. Other people call it other things. But to think about what it means to actually give up the privilege of being someone who doesn't suffer like our brothers and sisters do, and to walk with them. And I'll leave it there. Thanks.
Really appreciate Sue and walking the walk, and also Tristan actually being out there on the front lines. I'm going to cut this relatively short. I think I'll take about 5 minutes. I'm going to leave some materials if you'd like to read it afterwards. I'm going to try to bring this home, and Warner can clean up afterwards if he's uncomfortable with some of the things that I might say today. But the title of this was Occupy Zarahemla. And Zarahemla is a Book of Mormon term, and we're talking about our LDS faith, the Mormon faith community, and how this hits home to us. So let me start with the last story I was going to tell, and maybe just add a few things afterwards on a personal level. When Occupy Wall Street was started here in Salt Lake City, I decided to go there the first day. It was a real polyglot of individuals. You had the Tea Party groups and the Ron Paul types, which parts of that I really like, especially the anti-war. You had the progressives, you had Obama supporters, you had conservatives. You had a whole broad spectrum of individuals that were there the first day, and I spoke to a lot of them. It was fascinating. I even talked to a BYU student that thought, hey, this is really cool, you know, let's engage and talk. So I went there a number of times and talked to the leaders there, and actually went there and gave a statement once. But then I was invited to give a spiritual message. They had what's called a sacred circle. Have any of you been to Occupy Wall Street in Salt Lake City? Here? Okay. They had a little circle there where they had Sunday services, so to speak. So it was time to go to church. I live in Alpine. We were getting ready to go. And I said, geez, you know, I real hard time getting my 15-year-old to go to church. And I said, look, how about let's go to a different church today? And he was really excited about that. So we went up to Occupy Wall Street, and I took my quad with me, and I thought, you know, I had all these scriptures outlined about, you know, if you're not one, you're not mine, things about poverty. And I started, when I went there, there was a relatively small group like this, a little bit bigger, and I started quoting scriptures. And man, I was losing them real fast. They were like, okay, this is really boring. Then I said, okay. And then in the meantime, while I'm quoting from the Book of Mormon, I had a guy on the left of me that said, oh, have you ever heard of Ethan Smith or the Spalding and the Book of Mormon and the Book of Mormon and this and that? And I said, okay, you know, I'm not going there. But let me tell you two stories, and then you tell me if you think the Book of Mormon is true and if it's applicable. And so the first story I told was, of course, of King Benjamin. And I said, there was a very righteous king that labored with his own hands. He was a man of the people. And he said things like, we're all beggars. And don't let any beggar put up their petition in vain, including the good nurse here, Sue Cannon. Don't let him put it up. And he says, you know what? We are really nothing. Everything we have is from God. And so I told him that story in a longer version I'm telling now. And then I told him the story, and this is kind of our theme of Occupy Zarahemla. I said, let me tell you another story from the Book of Mormon. There's a story of a city that became very wealthy and prosperous, and they were also very spiritual, and they conjoined the secular with the spiritual. And they created massive synagogues, and they created these big buildings. And in the process of doing that, they were trying to get rid of what they would call urban plight. We didn't want the unpretty people to be downtown, basically. And then, on top of it, they had a big synagogue that they'd meet every so often, and they'd get up there and say, look, we're really chosen, and God has chosen us as the special people, and we're really happy about it that we're not like these unchosen people over here. And then I read this scripture. I'm not going to read it right now, but you know the scripture where it talks about how because of their poor clothing. In other words, they didn't shop at Tiffany's or some of the stores that we know of right now in some spacious malls. Say, look.
Around Alma 32-ish.
Pardon?
It's around Alma 32-ish.
You're right.
When it's talking about the Zoramites.
The Zoramites.
And cast them out before.
Yeah. They said, you know what, we don't feel comfortable going down there. And I don't think we're really welcome there. Now, when I was in Las Vegas, I was part of a panel that was building a state-of-the-art homeless center. They are raising massive amounts of money, the Red Cross and so forth, and they said, you know what? We're going to be known as a state-of-the-art center. Not that we'd ever think of that doing it here, but, you know, with limited funds. So, anyway, I told them the story, and not to be too boastful, but the crowd got bigger, and then the head guy there said, hey, this guy's got a really cool story to tell about Zoramites and this stuff. And a lot of them didn't know about Mormonism. So they brought in a big crowd, and the crowd got bigger, and he said, you got to tell that story again. That's a really cool story. And I said, okay, I'll tell the story. And so this time I began to embellish a little bit more, kind of like Elder Cunningham and, Mormon musical. And so I got bigger and bigger. But you know what? Whether we believe it applies to us or not, those people actually said, we get it. This story really resonates with us. And so anyway, let me just close. It was a real interesting experience. And then I think Tristan hit it dead on. You look at and observe what's actually happened. Then you go back to the scriptures and say, what is really happening to us? You got to love Mormon 8. Mormon 8 tells us, you know, if there's anything that tells us the Book of Mormon's true, it's the prophetic nature of the Book of Mormon, where it says that we will have the Holy Church of God, and what will we do with it? We'll pollute it. And how will we pollute it? It's not that we don't do good things for the poor and the needy. It's just that we do far less for them than we do for other things, like building buildings and things of granite and stone. I was the person quoted in that Business Week article on the Bloomberg. I don't know if you're aware of that. I'm that previous bishop. And had a chance to talk to them. So let me just give you a couple things real quick. One is here's the fuller story I write, Tristan and I and Josh write for the Mormon Worker, and I can leave it here if you want to look it up. It's called themormonworker.wordpress.com. You can get it later if you want to, where we have articles addressing where we talk about spiritual things and relate it to this Occupy Wall Street and things of that nature. Also, the other thing that I learned from Occupy Wall Street, just in closing, is the one neat thing about, people say, look, Occupy Wall Street, what the heck were they doing? But one thing they were doing is they were giving people a voice, the Sue Cannons, the Tristan, and the others, a voice. And in our theology, we have a Doctrine and Covenants 26:2. It says, and it is by common consent you shall do all things, all things. And section 104 says, look, nothing's coming out of consecrated funds in the church treasury unless it is by common consent and the voice of the people. That's not something our church leaders or we can give away. We own it as members. The Lord set it up. If anybody has a problem with that, talk to the Lord about it. Now, lately all we do is we just say we sustain the individual and then they go do what they want. And that corporate part of the church is getting huger and huger by the minute. And it's the tail wagging the dog. And I say, sign this petition. There's a petition that I was introduced to. It's called By Common Consent. And it says, and it's very proactive. It says, we got nothing to hide. This is wonderful that we have these consecrated funds. We just want an annual publication of all the money that's going into the church and where it's being spent. And that Bloomberg article says that 0.07% of all the money going into our church now is spent for humanitarian.
0.7.
Pardon?
0.7. Sorry.
Yeah, 0.7. I'm sorry. Anyway, I've got to close this. Just leave it time for Warner and discussion. Thank you.
Well, this has been fun, huh? I appreciate all of you. You've heard the theory. You've heard some concepts. You've heard some legal perspectives from our lawyer friends. You've heard from students mobilizing. You've heard from unions and nurses and healers. I'm up here just as a humble BYU professor who's trying to get some extra credit and an increase in my wage by speaking here today. And it's been nice to know y'all. I think we have had a fun panorama, kind of, where this movement's going. I have way too many things to say and not enough time to say it, but I think if you have not yet gone out someplace to some Occupy group, you should find one somewhere. They're still out there in some places. And spend some time. I've enjoyed doing that with Little Occupy Provo when we protested. It was, 18 degrees last winter, right in front of Zion Bank's big, beautiful entrance. Had participated in meetings that they call the General Assembly. Sometimes they call it church on Sundays, I guess. They have some rich times as well.
How many were there in Provo?
In Provo that night, there were about 10, 12 of us, maybe. Sometimes there's 15 or 20. Usually there's half a dozen. And, you know, I first came to the Salt Lake when I could get up here from my job, and I just loved listening to those people. I learned a lot. I found there were people there from Oregon who came down to join. There were professors from the U of U. I didn't find the other BYU ones, but I did find a number of BYU students there over the months. And wherever I've gone, whether it was speaking in Madrid, Spain, or San Francisco, or Sacramento, California, or D.C., at a conference there to talk about Mormon poverty and wealth, from coast to coast, it's been great for me to have learned a lot, found lots of stuff I didn't know, and be able to sense in the eyes of those I talked with, or when we marched to the Capitol, or marched against the bank, or whatever occasion it was, to find how valid their views are, how strong their feelings are, in many cases, how powerless they feel, and to get a sense of their dreams of a better world, their dreams of a new world. How does Occupy relate to Mormonism? We've heard a little about it. As I summarize some of the themes I see in the websites and the blocks of the occupiers over this last year plus. They talk a lot about being against greed, against inequality, against the values of Wall Street. In Mormon vernacular, we would say against the wealthy, against the rich, against Nehor, against Korihor, against social Darwinism. The themes of the church I pull out of some of the literature as well as the discussions I've had. The Occupy principle seem to fit fairly congruently with a number of LDS ideas, such as George Q. Cannon, who, quote, "The growth of wealth in the hands of a few individuals threatens us with greater danger today than anything that can be done by outsiders." He's talking about we the people. "God does not design there should be classes among us, one class lifted above another." Orson Pratt, Apostle Pratt, "Inequality of property is the root and foundation of innumerable evils. It tends to derision and to keep asunder the social feelings that should exist among the people of God. It's a principle originated in hell. It's the root of all evil. It's inequality of riches that's the great curse in our society." Brigham talked about needing to take a moral view, a political view, and see the inequality in our society in their day, in the day of the pioneers, those who settled here, those first decades. "It's an unequal condition to mankind. That is the great curse on the earth today. The Latter-day Saints will never accomplish their mission until this inequality shall cease on the earth, until we can all go to City Creek and shop at the designer stores instead of Walmart, where most of us have to shop today." I don't have time to talk about it. Let me just kind of ramble 2 more minutes.
Yeah, that was the cue.
We got 2 minutes.
Seven,
yeah, Lorenzo Snow. "What should we do with our money? We should employ our surplus. Our surplus means in a manner that the poor can have employment and see before them a competence and the conveniences of life. Not invest in Glenn Beck's gold commercials. You know, not invest in the big fancy stores in downtown Salt Lake or Provo or any place else. Occupy Wall Street, occupy Salt Lake, occupy Provo is a call to action. Maybe it's not going to be done so much collectively in big, powerful movements, because we're killing the unions in our country and deunionizing and breaking organized labor as fast as we can so that we can have more unions on Wall Street of the CEOs there and so forth. I think I read this about last year. Maybe it was 2010 or it was 2011. New York City gained 87,000 new millionaires in 1 year. That's Korihor stuff to me. Here's John Taylor. "We're engaged in the work God has sent his hand to accomplish, to introduce correct principles of every kind. Principles of morality, social principles, good political principles. The Lord has called us to be his co-adjusters and co-laborers in building Zion." The bottom line for me is I hope and pray that we as Latter-day Saints can see ways we can influence the church, influence our wards and our neighbors. Maybe something will happen in Salt Lake. Maybe little by little, the pressures from the poor, the cries of the poor, the struggles of those children who aren't, they don't have enough nutrition, they don't have enough protein to live, children in our church. We struggle with the problems of homelessness. My community for 5 years has been trying to build a homeless center in Provo, Utah. We've never had one. They finally got the funds together, about $4 million to build it. But because it's not paid off, the board has decided we can't actually have homeless people staying in there. talk about the principles of Wall Street and capitalism. And yet, over these years, when we've said, or we've heard, or it's been argued by officials in the Chamber of Commerce, in the business community, in the local government, in the county, as well as the city government, we can't afford something like that. They put together a huge fund of $40 million and built a new convention center in downtown Provo. To me, that is exactly why we need the Book of Mormon, and it's exactly why we need Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Provo. Thanks very much.
We got a few minutes for a few questions. If anyone has questions for anyone, brave souls.
Maybe let me just say that this is up here. If you want to just, we have a lot of copies of this. We've got about 650 signatures throughout the world right now, and we just barely put it out, or people put it out. I don't know who put it out. Anyway,
whoever
it's out there. Pardon?
Whoever we is.
Yeah, the 600. And what it is, it's very straightforward. It cites the doctrine of common consent. And for 130 years, our church published annually a full financial disclosure where all the money went. And then in 1960, it stopped for reasons we can discuss later. And it's out there on the internet if anybody wants to read it. It's very straightforward. It's very positive. It's not critical. But we're just simply asking that we return to our full common consent that we used to have doctrinally for 130 years in our church. Anyway.
So any questions?
Yeah.
Got a hand over here.
Well, I was just thinking about the concept of Zion. And Zion is where the pure in heart dwell. And we live in reality. We have ideals. And so
since 1990, between 1990 and 2008. There's something like 45 countries that we've bombed since World War II, but that's clustered more recently.
We've invaded, I think, 123 countries since America was founded. We've been at war the whole time, multiple wars the whole time.
I would like to see a visual.
Email me, I'll send you a list.
Okay.
I don't know if it's official, but send you a list.
There's a lot of good visuals.
There's a lot of visuals in there.
Because, you know, going back to the idea of purity of heart and how we get... who was speaking about against... Was that you again?
What?
we're against poor whore, we're against...
Yeah.
Is that you?
Yeah, that was Warner.
Okay.
Hard to remember.
And, sorry.
That was 3 minutes ago.
But it is true that our Constitution, our Bill of Rights...
Yeah.
Bill of Rights... is about against, whereas in other countries it's more four. And there's a very different concept and construct that we're working towards, because if in America it's, you know, our freedoms are guaranteed by saying we are against this, we're against having people come in our homes and saying they get to eat all our food and they're the maritime or they're the military, and, you know, that doesn't happen a whole lot anymore, but we're against those things. Whereas in a lot of other countries, they're going, we're for health care. And there's a real difference there in how the societies are built, if you see what I'm saying.
All right. Well, thanks for your comments. I don't think we have any more time, right? We're out.